All right, if you will, read with me verses 1 through 3 of our 1 Timothy chapter 5. Do not rebuke an older man, but exhort him as a father, younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women as sisters with all purity. Honor widows who are really widows. Those are some very short exhortations. Again, specifically given to Timothy in his position as an evangelist. We have emphasized in our study already just how important it is for each of us to make the proper applications in this. And so there are some general and broad applications that can be made. In other words, all of us should have respect for our elders. All of us should act with purity towards those who are of the opposite sex or gender. And all of us should be mindful of the relationships we sustain and how easily it is that those can be damaged if we're not approaching one another in the right way. And we emphasized in our study last Sunday morning the call to not rebuke an older man but exhort him as a father. And in this we described the similarities between the family relationship and the spiritual relationship that we enjoy one with another. And those are what we refer to as analogs. They can be explained and described in the same way. So the type of relationship that you would sustain with your father, showing the proper respect for his position, his age, is something that should be present when you are seeking to correct someone who is older than you. I think that the parallels that are given here as the admonition, do not rebuke an older man, exhort him as a father. He begins to talk men as younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, and younger women as sisters. That all of those are seeking to say, this is the way you treat your family. This is the way you should treat your spiritual family as well. And so it's important that we acknowledge those relationships, the dignity that is to be recognized, and the respect that is to be afforded an individual who is an older Christian, one who is older than ourselves, and the right and proper relationship that we should sustain with one another if we are equals in age. And so we talked about that primarily with regard to the older men. And so now we want to note the younger men as brothers. And again, the same basic thought is the kinship that we enjoy should impact our behavior when we're correcting other Christians. And that's specifically the context here. And again, mindful of the fact that Timothy is an evangelist, it's going to become necessary for Timothy through the exhortation of the word to convict individuals and to correct individuals when they have gone astray. How should he approach that situation? So here in 1 Timothy 5, he tells them that you are to treat them just as you would treat a brother, a physical brother. So that kinship impacts that behavior. Brotherhood would compel us to be understanding, be patient, to be loving, to show our concern just like we would with our own fleshly kin. So there is a parallel to be found there. And I don't know whether, I mean, again, we'll open this up to any discussion questions that you might have, but let's just kind of make note of the other two that are under consideration here. And that is that what is good for the males is good for the females. So as an evangelist, Timothy is to treat older women as mothers. And so the same dignity that the older man has as a result of his age, that should be recognized and respected when you're dealing with an older woman. You would treat her just as you would treat your mother. And I think that the specific exhortation given in verse 1, not to rebuke an older man, but exhort him as a father, you would say not to rebuke an older woman, but exhort her as a mother. The only extra thing that we might note in this is with regard to the relationship you sustain with the opposite sex. Because you'll notice there is a little added thing in verse 2 of the text. The younger women as sisters with all purity. And that would have reference to the sexual aspect. And so when we talk about the younger women as sisters with purity, again, that brings to light what could be a real problem, especially with evangelists. And you can see the problem potentially. with regard to one who is considered an individual who is imparting spiritual wisdom, that there might be a developing of affection that comes as a result of that, which can be taken advantage of and has been again and again and again. So it's interesting that in the first century, as Paul's dealing with these issues, that he makes a specific mention of the importance of being pure in your treatment of the opposite sex, because if you have any knowledge of what has happened among God's people in our generation and in previous generations, you know anecdotally that there have been preachers who have been caught having affairs with individuals, women in the congregation. It's something that has happened again and again and again. And it's either one of two things. Either the care that is called upon in this particular text is not being respected. It's not being heeded. In other words, someone thinks, well, it's not going to happen to me, and they're not being careful with regard to how they treat one another, or it's being just disregarded. In other words, you have someone who is, if not a predator, one that we could say is unconcerned about those things and desirous of doing that, using the position that he has. And so the call to be pure, that idea of purity is that young preachers need to be especially admonished. I'll give you a quote from Marshall Patton in his commentary. He said, "Not one word, look, or action should ever suggest improper feelings on the preacher toward the woman, upon their part. The character and usefulness depend so much upon their observance of this precept. Paul, by this timely admonition to young Timothy, shows knowledge of human nature and the danger of temptation that is so often present in the work." And again, there are individuals who will tell you when they get caught up in a situation or circumstance like that, they never intended it to happen. But it is something that can be avoided simply by this point that he makes. Not one word, look, or action should ever suggest improper feelings. And so I'll just, because it's something that as a preacher I am aware of, I'll just say what I've made it my practice to do, and that is to always have Debbie present whenever there is a necessity of talking with someone in a private setting, of not being alone at the building with women who are here working, of making the decision to make sure that there's always a second person present. It's not that I think that anything necessarily bad would happen, but there is that possibility that the reputation could be marred, and there is a possibility for temptation. It's always a part of human nature, and it should be noted. And so many men have disregarded those instructions and that care that needs to be taken with regard to those of the opposite sex. And this is something that Paul tells Timothy. Timothy is a righteous young man, a paragon of virtue, as we know, but he's still admonishing him to these things. Now, it's not just the purview of the preacher, though. We need to recognize that this purity with regard to the relationships we sustain is something that is important as we acknowledge the place that marriage holds in God's plan for redeeming man, and that the dangers that are present. Divorce and remarriage happens so often as a result of adultery, as a result of fornication, and we need to recognize those dangers that are present and be careful in how we conduct ourselves with other people. Again, it's something that I've seen. There are two or three instances that come to my mind over the years of individuals that I trusted a great deal, felt that they were very righteous individuals who were all caught into affairs, and it had to do with the workplace every time. No, two of the three times that I've got in mind had to do with the workplace and how they just began to develop a relationship with a woman. And it was initially just a common interest or just an easy back and forth with regard to the personalities. But then it became a lunch on occasion, and then it became something that was less than innocent. And it was a progress. And they told me, and never intended it to get this far, but it destroyed their marriages because they allowed that to happen. And it's best not to allow yourself to get into those kinds of circumstances, those kinds of relationships. And I know that in our day and time, that's not well respected. In fact, it is considered to be perhaps misogynistic to think that way. I do know, for example, that Vice President Pence has that particular condition that is placed upon his interactions with women that he works with, that he'll never be alone with them. And he has been accused of being misogynistic in his actions, that is prejudicial, and it's it makes it more difficult for women to have their place and to do their work. But he has more of an interest in maintaining his marriage and his reputation than he does that. And so that's a decision that he has made. He's been roundly criticized, but as far as I understand, he's not backed down on it at all with regard to his personal convictions. So it's important. And as Christians, we have a different standard than the world. We need to recognize that is the case. But it is especially important when you talk about the responsibility that preachers, and especially young preachers, the dangers that are present in that regard, and be mindful of them. All right, so we'll open it up. Anything anybody wants to add?
Yes. Well, there's something that kind of came to my mind, and I don't have the scripture right at the tip of my fingers, but it's an assumption in this, although it's well taught in other scriptures, how our family relationships are to be and how we're to do with them. But in our society today, you know, there's brother against brother, and you know, some against mother and child, and so those say this is an assumption here of how a Christian should be treating their own family.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So, I mean, I understand that this is specific to this right here,
right?
But that little bit is an assumption.
Oh, certainly. Whenever you have, and we can say the same thing with regard to, for example, in Ephesians 5, when you talk about the husband-wife relationship and the relationship that Christ sustains to the church. And I've mentioned a number of times is it's sometimes kind of difficult to figure out whether he's using the church to explain how a husband-wife ought to be, or he's using the husband-wife relationship to explain how Christ's relationship is in the church. Now, we understand the ideal of Christ and his relationship to the church, but if you're using the husband-wife relationship to show this is the way Christ is with the church, it has to be recognized as the way that the husband-wife relationship is supposed to be. And that's always the case when those kinds of parallels are made. What does God expect of this? Well, if you understand what God expects with regard to how you treat your father, how you treat your mother, how you treat your brother and sister, well, that's the same way that you should treat individuals in the church with that relationship. So it has to be that ideal thing. Yeah, that's a good point to make. All right, anybody else have questions or comments about that section? Yes, sir.
Along that line, one of the members at North Beach related the situation there when he was a preacher at Studebaker Road in Long Beach, California, with one of the women that maybe intentionally or not kind of come on to him, you know. And so he told his wife, whenever she comes over here, you get in between you and her, you know. I mean, he realized the situation there and let his wife know.
Well, there are three things that comes to mind. First of all, like I said, some preachers have been predatory, and that's certainly, of course, to be condemned and problematic. Some women, I guess we could say predatory as well. But one of the things about that is with a preacher relationship with individuals in the congregation is if he's respected and if he is helpful, that sometimes individuals, as a result of that, can develop feelings that especially if it's a babe in Christ or someone who has come out of the world or someone who is especially vulnerable, that can become a sticky situation as well, and you have to be careful about it. But the third thing is simply reputation. And so you say, you know, maybe nothing's going on at all. Maybe a woman comes in to work in the classroom and the preacher's in his office studying, and then you drive by and people see two cars out front. You know, nothing that's not innocent is going on, but there may be some talking that begins as a result of that kind of thing. So reputation is another part of it. That's not part of this context, but I think that it's an important thing to consider as well. But the idea is you conduct yourself with purity with regard to those of the opposite sex, and that's something that is an obvious thing. But the fact that Paul had to bring it up here, or felt the need to bring it up, is indicative of the dangers that are present we need to be aware of. But again, that has to do with all of our relationships. It's not just the evangelist that needs to be careful about that. Okay, anything else?
On that verse 3, also, there's a limit. Well, not a limit. I'm not the word. Description or whatever of the widows that are widows indeed.
Uh-huh.
And in our society today, they don't even consider this, I don't think.
No, you're right about that. We're actually... we're going to kind of be talking about the next section in two different parts. I added, as I mentioned last week as we began this, or a couple of weeks ago as we began this study, in chapter 5 and verse 3, it's actually a part of a bigger context that goes all the way down to verse 16. And it deals with the way in which a congregation is to treat one of their number. So you have a widow who is in the number, in the congregation. Understanding that widows are without, or especially in the first century, were without any external support. There wasn't governmental pensions, for example. There wasn't an opportunity for her to have some kind of pension from work that she had done. We've got things built into our structure and our society that are a little bit different then. So a widow in the first century was very much dependent upon family. And upon the church, if she was a Christian, to be able to live, gain sustenance, have something to eat, a roof over her head. And as a result of that, in Acts chapter 6, for example, there were widows that were being tended to in what was referred to as the daily ministration, having reference to the feeding of the widows. It was something that was done at the very beginning and infancy of the church. Here in 1 Timothy chapter 5, there are instructions as to how churches are to deal with the widows among them. And a distinction is made between those who are widows with family and those who are widows without family. And the widows indeed are the ones that are the widows that do not have family to take care of them. And we're going to talk about that because there are a couple of reasons for that. Number one, it has to do with the familial responsibility. As Christians, we need to take a special care of those who belong to us, who are in need, as an individual Christian. Remember, the Pharisees were condemned by Jesus because they didn't feed their parents, they didn't support their parents when they were in need, because they had made a gift to God. And as such, the Pharisees said, you don't have to take care of your parents. And Jesus condemned them for making the commandments of God of no effect by the traditions. Well, we could be guilty of the same thing if we're not careful, and would be judged justly by God for the same reason as the Pharisees in that case. But he does make a distinction between the widows who do not have someone to help and care for them, and there are certain of those who have the right to be cared for by the congregation. So we're going to talk about that. And that, because of that responsibility, plus the error that has crept in the Lord's church with regard to human institutions and the way these things are handled. So we want to make that distinction, but we're going to do that a little bit later, because here I think that it's important to note that as a part of introducing this section, he's given an instruction to Timothy, as he has with the treatment of older men, older women, younger men, younger women, to honor also widows who are really widows. And I do think that there is a specific reference to Timothy as an evangelist to be taking the lead with regard to how the church is to deal with these individuals, but for himself to be respectful and to honor the widows. The word honor there, it means to show respect for, to venerate, to be deference to an object, or in this case a person, because of its value. And sometimes that deference that is shown and that care and concern that is shown will have a financial aspect to it. It involves financial support, which is why Jesus said, honor your father and mother, and said, you're taking money that could be given to them and you're reserving it as a gift to God, and thus you're violating this command to honor. So honor there, Jesus readily applied, and of course it was something well known by the Jews, had reference to supporting them physically. So they're of age that they can't work anymore, they have no means of obtaining sustenance, It's your responsibility as a child to take care of them, their child to take care of them. And the same thing is true with regard to the church, with regard to those who are widows. Sometimes that requires help for them, showing financial support to them. But you'll notice, again, it says honor widows who are really widows. And so the distinction comes in here as to what does it mean to really be a widow. And we know that the definition of a term widow means you don't have a husband. You've lost your husband. And of course, in the first century, the husband was the primary means of support. So a woman who did not have her husband would not have that support, where she would have money that she could use to buy food and to have a place to stay and to live on. But he says really widows. So that indicates, again, it's a as the distinction is made, because you can go down just a little bit. And in verse 4 it says, if any widow has children or grandchildren. So the children and grandchildren means that she's a widow, but she's not really a widow. Or a widow, but not a widow indeed. So what does that mean? Well, what it means is, she is a widow in the sense that she's lost her husband, but she's not destitute because she has family who can care for her. And here is this instruction, is that the church is to be mindful, and as an evangelist, Timothy was to be mindful of the widows in his congregation, the widows there in Ephesus, who did not have any means of support. And a distinction is made there. They are to be venerated, they are to be respected, deference is to be shown to them. And in this case, because they are really widows, because they have no means of support, then support is to be rendered to them, given to them. And that's basically the sentiment that is expressed through the entirety of the 16 verses, as a part or from verse 3 to verse 16, so the 13 verses. And the idea is, you make a distinction. A distinction has to do with age. In other words, a younger woman who is widowed, she's lost her husband. She has been given instructions not to determine to live their lifetime under the in the role of the or under the care and protection of the church, but instead get married and have children. That's the intent that God has given. So he makes a distinction between older widows and younger widows, and then he makes a distinction between widows who are without family, widows who have family, and the responsibility of the family to care for those who are widows. And if they don't, they're worse than an infidel for not caring for their family. There are some pretty significant instructions given in this context that limit the responsibility of the local church in dealing with these things. But it also establishes what those responsibilities are with the intent that they be fulfilled. And we have to be respectful not only of the limitations, but we also have to be respectful of the requirements that God has given to the local church in this regard. And while we will say that it happens less often that those kinds of things, I know because I've had some insight as to what's going on, that there are or has been widows in this congregation who are really widows. And though they have some income, have not been sufficiently cared for to fulfill all their needs, whether it be medical costs that they might have or some other circumstance that arises. And this congregation, though it has not been required that we put them on the roll where we're fully supporting them, that we have had to offer support. And that was our duty as a congregation, a responsibility we have. But that is a limited responsibility, and it must be recognized as such. But we're going to talk a little bit more about that as time goes on. I just wanted to note that there was that special call to Timothy to be mindful of this group and to honor them. And if that honor requires that support be offered to them, to be sure that that is done. Okay? So, questions, comments about the first three verses of chapter 5. All right, then. We go down now to the next section, which is verses 19 through 22, as some other instructions are given. This one is one that we've discussed recently, but we'll just make note of it again. And that is where in verse 1 was talking about an older man. It's the same word that is used, presbyteros, there in verse 1 is verse 19. But there is, I think, contextually a change where older men in general were referred to in verse 1. There is a specific reference to those who are elders in a congregation or bishops or overseers, pastors. You'll notice in verse 17, let the elders who rule well be counted worthy of double honor. So here's a change in context where he's talking about specifically the office of an elder. And as a part of the office of an elder, he says to Timothy, this young evangelist, do not receive an accusation against an elder except from two or three witnesses, those who are sinning rebuke in the presence of all, that the rest may also fear. I charge you before God and the Lord Jesus Christ and the elect angels that you observe these things without prejudice, doing nothing with partiality. Do not lay hands on anyone hastily, nor share in other people's sins. Keep yourself pure. Now, so this has, again, the responsibility for personal integrity and care to be taken as an evangelist when dealing with elders in a local congregation. And I do think that this is, though, again, the principles can be broadly applied because all of us should have such respect for men who are serving as elders. It's especially important for an evangelist. And the reason for this is that evangelists can be put in a position to where they are either exercising more authority than they actually have, or are considered to be more authoritative because of the influence that they wield, because of the obvious and visible position that they hold as they address the congregation quite extensively, quite often. So as a result of that, if there was an effort made on the part of the evangelist to be overtly seeking to undermine the elders, he could, as a result of his influence and because of his position, be effective in that. The preacher is given the responsibility to be one who is an advocate for the eldership. And that is the default state that should be present. And so what has been my practice over the years is if someone comes up to me and they say, this particular thing I've got against the elders or I've got this problem with them, is go talk to the elders about it. And I would quote this passage. I'm not supposed to be entertaining these kinds of things. I'm not supposed to be an advocate for you. I'm supposed to be an advocate for the eldership. You go and talk to them about those and work those things out. Now, there are limits with regard to this. Notice he says there in the text, beginning of verse 9, do not receive an accusation against an elder except from two or three witnesses. So now we have a situation or circumstance to where there is an abundance of evidence that has been supplied that the elder is acting in an inappropriate way. And it's not saying that you should ignore sin, because this would be an accusation of sin. Not that you ignore sin, but that that you do not entertain those things unless there is sufficient reason or cause to do so. The default state should be a support of the elders, unless it becomes obvious that that support is not appropriate, and you have to be careful in the way you deal with those situations. It's something we, of course, are very much aware of. Yes, please.
Well, aren't there similarities between what it says about if you have something against a brother?
Similarities, but there's a problem with this, and sometimes it gets conflated, and it's actually one of the points that in looking at this, it's important we note. There's nothing that is stated in this that has reference to private sin. So when you say do not receive an accusation against an elder, let's say that an elder is guilty of sexual immorality, as an example. And that sexual immorality is exposed, so it becomes evident to all in the congregation. Now you've got witnesses that are aware of what is going on. It's a public matter. It's not a private matter. In that kind of situation, the idea that, okay, it has to be dealt with privately, where you go to him, one person goes to him first, and then takes two or three if that doesn't work, and then you take it before the church, is different because it's already a public matter. If it's a private matter between a man and the elder, in the first place, he shouldn't be coming to the preacher anyway. He should be going to the elder privately and trying to deal with that. If that doesn't work, then take two or three witnesses and then again go before the church. But here is and again, as a preacher, I know this happens. Individuals will have a problem and they don't want to handle that problem head on, so they want to recruit the preacher to be on their side to help them with it. that's a dangerous situation, and that's something that the preacher ought to avoid. And I think that's the instruction that's given here. We need to recognize that you cannot conflate what happens in private with regard to private sin between two individuals and something that happens publicly. And there are any number of passages which teach that, but we sometimes get into this habit, and you'll hear people say this, a sin becomes known. And so the sin is dealt with. The question is, well, did you go to him privately? Did you go to him privately? As if every single type of sin or every single circumstance of sin requires that the person be approached singularly in private first of all. And that's not what the scriptures teach. In Matthew chapter 18, that's taught, because if your brother has something against you, or you have something against your brother, it's supposed to be, and specifically in that case, your brother sinned against you, you have a responsibility to go to your brother. If he hears you, you've gained a brother. If he doesn't hear you, take two or three. If he doesn't hear them, take it to the church. If he doesn't hear the church, he's to be treated as one unworthy of fellowship. But in Galatians, the second chapter, beginning in verse 11, you might want to turn there just so that we'll make note of that difference and distinction that is there. We have a circumstance where you have one who was greatly respected in the church, and that is the Apostle Peter. The Apostle Peter was guilty of sinning in this particular circumstance. We're told in verse 11 of the text that Peter had come up to Antioch, and this is Paul writing, and Paul said, "I withstood him to his face because he was to be blamed." So there's nothing yet in that context that indicates it's public. But he came to Antioch. He's in Antioch now, Peter is. And Paul said, "I talked to him face to face about his sin. He was to be blamed." What was his sin? Well, before certain men came from James, he would eat with the Gentiles. But when they came, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing those who were of the circumcision. This was not a private matter. It was a public meal. So he's eating with Gentiles, but then here some Jews came in. He separated himself because he was afraid of what they would think of him. Now this is after Acts 15. This is after Peter had converted Cornelius in Acts chapter 10. This is after all those things had happened, and Paul was with Peter in Jerusalem in Acts 15 when they made the determination along with James by the arguments that Gentiles are included as well. So this was Peter backtracking. Peter was being hypocritical here because he feared those of the circumcision. And not only that, verse 13, the rest of the Jews played the hypocrite with him. So when they saw that Peter withdrew himself from the Gentiles, when these Jews came in with James, they withdrew themselves. Even Barnabas did. So Barnabas followed Peter's example. And here Paul is standing and looking and seeing what's happening, knows this to be sinful. And so we're told in verse 14, "When I saw they were not straightforward about the truth of the gospel, I said to Peter before them all, 'If you, a Jew, live in the manner of Gentiles and not as Jews, why do you compel Gentiles to live as Jews?'" He starts making the same arguments that were already made. He's convicting him of his sin and his hypocrisy in this, and he's doing it in front of all of them. Well, why? Well, because the sin was a public sin. And he was not only sinning, but he was leading others to sin as well. And Paul had to put a stop to it. And we cannot put these artificial restrictions this is the point I make with regard to dealing with this kind of sin. By putting those arbitrary distinctions that you can't deal with public sin publicly, it puts truth and it puts righteousness at a disadvantage. The advantage is on the individual who's engaging in the sinful activities, because he's overt, he's doing these things out in front of everyone, and you're requiring yourself to go to him privately and go through those kinds of processes. The private sin is a sin that is between two people. It's not something that is publicly known, and so you deal with it differently in that regard. So that is a good question, and it's certainly something we want to know with regard to the context that is here. But that's the point that is made. If it's something that is out there and obvious and others are coming to you about it, then the evangelist has the responsibility to deal with that sin, to be a part of dealing with it. But if it's something that is a private matter, it's something that cannot be corroborated, the evangelist, as a default, state, the default position, should be an advocate for the eldership. And it's important for us to understand that because, again, what happens with regard to elders who are ruling? When they rule well, they from time to time will have to do things that will be displeasing to an individual, just as an evangelist. Evangelist preaches a lesson, he steps on some toes in the lesson, some will be accepting of it, others will be resentful as a result of that. If an elder makes a decision that is needful with regard to admonition, it may be something that some will accept well, but others may be upset about it and antagonistic as a result of that. They're going to seek to recruit individuals to their side. The most dangerous individual to recruit to your side with regard to being effective in undermining an elder would be the preacher. So the preacher has to be careful about those things to make sure there is legitimately sin and that sin can be established. And when that is the case, then he can act. But he is to be careful in regard to that, as indicated in verse 19. All right? So, questions concerning that in our discussion?
Did you go over anything in verse 18? I think you read through some of it, but did you read that particularly?
No, because we're specifically talking about just the preacher's
sin.
Responsibility.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, in verses 17 and 18, and I do believe that I do later on go back and look at those things, but I don't know for sure, so we'll just make note of it. When we talk in verse 17 and 18, let the elders who rule well be counted worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in the word and doctrine. For the scripture says, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain, and the laborer is worthy of his wages. There is a specific authority that is given to support an elder monetarily as a part of his work. And again, the difference is, in the first century and today are marked, they're obvious with regard to the way in which our society treats individuals. If you didn't work in the first century because of age or not maybe some injury or some kind of restriction where you couldn't work, well then you didn't eat. In other words, there wasn't much in the way of support, whereas now there's governments that support. You have pensions if you've worked for a long while for a company. And that's not to say that everyone gets that, because they don't. They say that preachers, typically preachers work until they die because they don't have that kind of a pension. And, you know, if they're going to be supported, they're going to have to be preaching. And so not everyone falls under that umbrella. But having said that, we don't often hear of elders as a part of their work as an elder being given money out of the treasury and supported in that work. Now, just because we don't often see it doesn't mean that it's not authorized. It certainly is. As we talked about going back to chapter 5 and verse 3, honor widows who are really widows, and the fact that that honor sometimes has a financial element to it, the same thing is true with regard to elders here. Now, the difference between it is that it's a benevolent action in chapter 5 and verse 3, whereas it is an action of support. That is, work that is being done, being paid for. And ultimately, that's what happens with an evangelist. The wages that I receive, a laborer is worthy of his hire. I'm earning what I'm doing. It's not merely benevolence. There's a distinction that is to be made. It's support. It's not the exact same as what you might would consider with secular employment, but there are aspects to it that are very similar. Now, you'll notice in this text, elders who rule well be counted worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in the word, is that realization. And I know that some people will have a problem. They'll say, well, preacher ought not to be an elder. Well, you may say that there are some potential dangers, certainly, for preachers being elders. There might be some conflicts to where a preacher might would need to recuse himself, using the language of our day, as a result of that, where it might be a situation where it's abused. But having said that, there is no scriptural reason that is given why a preacher cannot also serve as an elder. And it even makes sense for that to be the case, because preachers typically are individuals who are well versed in the word and able to convict the gainsayer and are able to teach, which are some of the qualifications for elders. If the domestic qualifications fit, the character qualifications fit, and he is qualified to serve, as determined by the Holy Spirit, then it would be wrong for an individual in the church to say, well, you know, I was a member of a congregation once where the preacher was an elder and that didn't work out well. To say because of that circumstance and that situation that preachers ought not to serve as elders, because this text indicates that they have the right to do it. And as we've talked about with regard to the qualifications of elders, we don't have the right to refuse to accept an individual who the Holy Spirit qualifies. And so it's just something, one of those things where wouldn't it be smart if we didn't, or wouldn't it be better, or don't you think? You can't just have these personal convictions with regard to this if they are in direct contradiction to what the Word of God says. You can say we need to be mindful of it. This is something that could cause a problem. But you can't say we shouldn't do it when the Scripture very clearly says it can be done and should be done. And I think we get that from that text.
Don't we have an example, too, of an apostle being...
Well, Peter in 1 Peter 5. Identified himself as an elder. Certainly. Yeah. Okay, anybody else? Yes, Dick.
Of course, you mentioned about elder being a page. You never hear that these days, you know, an elder being paid like that. But there was one case I know that I heard of where he took upon his own about maybe 55 years ago this occurred. You know, I didn't know it personally, but he'd take $20 every week out of the contribution out of there.
So he was doing that on his own without anyone knowing?
Right.
I think that's called theft.
Right. Yeah. Of course, he finally realized that I don't know how many years that went on.
Wow.
And independent of it, I don't know if he paid it all back or not, but I think that's what $20 a week was quite a lot.
Well, that's again, any time you have something being done like that where it's not being, there needs to be some agreement and some acknowledgement of that. Otherwise, it's just
right.
Just taking money for yourself. That's not right. Yes,
no. I think it's also an indication of how much is required of an eldership involvement, to the point to where they would maybe need to be supported so that they can fully accomplish their work as an elder. I can see a situation where you have a man that's qualified, but because of the financial situation and the job he has, he simply doesn't have the time to fulfill the requirements that would be required of him as an elder of a congregation. And, at that point, the congregation could support him to the extent that he would need to be to fulfill that requirement.
That's a good point. And again, the financial realities of our society would make that a little bit, unless it's a very large congregation, a little bit troublesome, problematic, but it's something that certainly could be done. Yeah. Appreciate everyone's ideas in regard to that. Now, was that the first bell or second? Is this first? Okay, so we do have a couple more minutes. Let's continue on in the context just a little bit, and then we can get through verses 19 through 22. Now, I do want you to note in verse 20 of the text, he says, though you don't receive an accusation against an elder, he said, those who are sinning rebuke in the presence of all that the rest may also fear. So there, one who is sinning, an elder who is sinning, is to be rebuked. And notice it's in the presence of all, which again is indicative of a public rebuke. But I do want you to notice that the rest may also fear is not merely the rest of the elders. In other words, what we're talking about here is what's good for the goose is good for the gander. This is the way that sin is dealt with in the church. It's the way that it was dealt with in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 when the Corinthians finally started to do what they were supposed to do. And there is a purpose in such an external rebuke. When you deal with sin publicly, the congregation is aware of the fact that sin is a serious thing, and that an individual who is guilty of unrepentant sin is separated from God and will be separated from the people of God as a result of that sin. And those actions will lend them to fear in the sense of being aware of that and understand the situation and circumstance and how significant and serious it is. And as a result of that, they may be kept from sinning. And so that's one of the reasons why sin is dealt with. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. If you excise the leaven, then you remain pure. And that is important. Now, having said that, there are specific references in verses 21 and 22 about how Timothy is to behave himself in this regard. So he first of all says, I charge you before God, Jesus Christ, the elect angels, that you observe these things without prejudice, doing nothing with partiality. What that indicates is personal integrity in dealing with these matters. You don't act one way because this particular person is your friend, and then act a different way, deal with it differently because this particular individual you may not care as much about, or you may have something against, or some personality conflict. You have to make sure that righteousness is the purpose of all these things. It has nothing to do with personalities, nothing to do with who it is. You are to be impartial. Impartiality is one of the most important things that a preacher can have, and it's something that should be present with regard to all Christians. And so as a result of that, he says in verse 22, don't lay hands on anyone hastily. The laying on of hands here doesn't mean don't hit anybody. It has reference to the fact that when you're giving your approval, the laying on of hands is something that signifies approval. When the elders laid hands on Timothy, they were offering approval. As an evangelist, as he was appointing elders, Titus was given those instructions. In Acts 14, Paul and Barnabas went and they laid hands on individuals, appointing individuals as elders. It is a sign of approval. Don't give your sign of approval hastily. You want to make sure that this individual is worthy of that before you sign off on it by laying hands on them. And that says, don't do that with partiality. Don't lay hands hastily. Don't share in other people's sins. If there's a person who's not qualified to serve, but he's adamant to usurp that position, and you go along with it, then you're sharing in his sin. You make sure that you don't let that happen. You've got to be careful about who it is that you choose in this regard. And he says, don't share in their sin. Keep yourself pure. Always act with integrity to ensure that you're not corrupted by the sins that others are committing. It takes integrity to act in that way, and that's something that he calls the young man Timothy enduring. All right? Let us pick up then. That gets us through chapter 5 and verse 22. So we'll get into chapter 6, verses 11 through 16. We'll finish our duties of the preacher next week by looking at those verses in the 6th chapter. Thank you much for your kind attention today. Thank you.